Institute. Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Your ultimate culinary companion.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Dishing It Out with me, Gary O'Hanlon.
And me, Gareth Mullins.
And coming up on today's show, we have gone back to the bucket or bowl, or I don't know what to call this little...
Well, it's a bucket now.
It's
was
a bucket
a bowl,
now, yeah. Ed or ever... classy producer.
Ed's bucket, yeah. What's wrong with it?
Ed's bucket. Ed brought a bucket of questions with him, sir. You know, a man likes to drink from a bucket, likes to take all the stuff from a bucket. So, yeah, we did one of these, I think, in and around Christmas time, which was rightly into season one, and we had a wee bit of crack with it. So, we're going to get into that today. So, hopefully, there's a couple of wee curveballs in there, I imagine, knowing Ed. So, let's go. Don't go anywhere.
Okay, so next up now, we've got our little mystery bucket. Is that what we're calling it? Ed's mystery bucket.
The bucket of truth.
Yeah, well, hopefully it's the bucket of truth.
So. Today FM yellow bucket.
So the first question I've got here is, if you ever had to cook a dish again for the rest of your life, what would it be? And if it could only be one other dish for the rest of your life, what would it be? So we need to think one dish that if you never had to cook it again, happy days, and then the one dish that you want to cook for the rest of your life. Is there anything that you just don't like doing?
Anything I don't like doing? Well, I'll tell you what I'll go with first. I'll go with what I could easily cook. I could easily cook a salt-fried Johnstone sirloin steak for the rest of my life. If I also got to eat it every day for the rest of my life. Even better.
A steak.
Yeah, a sirloin steak. Yeah, not a ribeye, not a fillet, whatever. I absolutely adore the cut. I love sirloin, like a center cut sirloin steak. You know, we all know my thoughts on Johnstone beef at this stage. Just great, really well looked after, dry aged, Irish grass fed beef. And the sirloin just has a tiny wee bit of cap fat on it, and then a Maldon Flex salt, just completely, you're almost putting on more salt than you think that it needs, and a really good like inch and a half, almost 2 inch thick.
Fat
like,
just gets so delicious, doesn't it?
Yeah, and the salt is going
to me.
The salt is going to start pulling that marble into the surface, and then as that comes out, hits the salt, and then the salt is on your flat top and or your red hot scorch pan, it then meets the salt crust. You cook it without touching it. You flip it over. A lot of chefs will tell you that you get a better caramelization on the meat if you don't salt it before you're cooking it, and I get that, but it's just not for me. Like, I know dairy likes to salt it afterwards. There is nothing you can penetrate seasoning into if you're only seasoning it after the fact. I don't care if you've had a Michelin star or 10 stars. Meat has got to be seasoned before it's cooked for it to penetrate, for me anyways, and a salt fried Johnstone sirloin steak would do it for me all day long. Love it.
For me, I really, really enjoy cooking a nice piece of fish. So yeah. If it's either a piece of turbot or a piece of Dover sole or a bit of John Dory, and I know I'm giving you, but it's really that understanding of how to get the cuisson, is what we say, or
well, the
cooking
fish,
degree just right.
Fish separates the cooks from the chefs.
Yeah, no, big time. And look, it's something that, again, I'd happily eat a piece of fresh fish pan roasted every single day for the rest of my days. As much as, and I love beef, you know I do as well. Mm. But I just think there's a real skill and a little bit of delicacy needed for cooking a piece of fish correctly. As you just said, like, you very, very identify a good cook when you ask them to roast you a scallop,
yeah,
or over salt, yeah, or pan fry me a piece of sea bass there and get the skin nice and crispy.
Yeah.
You know, because it's all around temperature control. It's understanding how much heat to give it, when to add the butter, when to add the herbs, how long to let it rest for. So, yeah, the reason I like it, I suppose, is the skill around it. I really enjoy the skill part of it. Where a steak... Cooking a steak, of course, takes a lot of skill, but it's a lot more forgiving.
Yeah.
And then have you got something that you'll never cook again?
And you know, it only came to me there. I wouldn't say never cook again, but never have to do again. So I put this new tequila prawn skewer with a fresh pineapple salsa on the Palmer North menu recently. If I never have to peel another langoustine or Dublin Bay prawn again for the rest of my days, it'll be too soon. That's a job you really want to hold off for that person that's melted your brain all day. You don't like, or they're annoying you. I just cannot
the
imagine.
Complex the lad now yeah, on the park.
I can't.
Standing there peeling those prawns.
He gave them to
what did I do? Yeah, yeah. It used to be go clean the oven, you know, and I was like, ah, oh, good yeah. man.
I have a job with you.
A man, Adam. Prawns. Yeah, you're on the prawn. Peeling prawns would. But you take you to a dark place, man.
Yeah, can do. Can
somebody has to do it.
Especially when there's a couple of blades and 20 kilo boxes.
I know. They don't come in wee packages, do you? What about you guys? What
do
would
you know what? If I never have to cook, eat, look at, be around, is a courgette. I've fucking no time for courgettes, man. Right I up, eat them and I use them. Yeah. And you know, I actually have a dish on the menu at the moment in the restaurant.
Right up there with cucumbers. You wonder what it's all about.
I actually like cucumbers.
No. Yeah. So do I.
It's just courgettes.
Water with texture.
And you know the middle part of them? I just don't get them. I just don't. Now, I know how you can't make a ratatouille if you haven't got one.
No.
You know, totally contradicts myself now, but the Graham Neville's courgette flour that you use.
Ah, yeah.
I may not eat that dish for the rest of my life till I die. It's like incredible.
Yeah, but it's the flour he's giving
you.
No,
it's the mousse, the dinner.
Yeah, the lobster mousse or scallop mousse.
The courgette is just there just to make it look pretty, but... Yeah, I think courgettes, see you later. No time.
Too much water content. Exactly. Very hard. They make everything look like shit.
And you have to work so hard to get any type of blade and flavour into them. Yeah. So yeah, they're the two for me. I don't know. People were probably expecting us to say heart or liver or one of those things. I like cooking all.
Oh no, I'd eat away at liver. Yeah, yeah, it's lovely.
It's a challenge. All right, come on. Give us a look. What have we got?
Wee dip. Okay. We always hear about your dream dinner party guests, but who's on the guest list for your dinner party from hell?
Ooh. Oh, Ed is trying to drag us into a dark hole here.
Yeah, yeah. Right. We'll go away. We'll go with three each, okay? Who would be right up there?
I'll start. At the moment, just because I'm so surrounded in it, politicians at the moment, I can't spend a lot of time. I don't have no interest now in sitting with a politician at my table at the moment. That's a very broad stroke.
Yeah.
But I just feel it's being rammed down my throat at the moment.
Yeah, well, there's elections on, man, dear.
I know, but like I just don't get all these everywhere, all these blading posters. And I still find, and I'm someone that reads a bit, like I look at the news, I read newspapers. I still find when you go into the election hall and you get that and all those names, I still don't think they've the communication right. Now, I know they're knocking on your door. I'm never at home and they knock. Denise likes to talk politics with me, as both of us do, because we care about the country being run. But at the moment, I just want a bit of crack when I'm at the dinner table and I just don't want to be listening to all the nonsense going on. So thanks for that one, Ed. Yeah, good man.
Bringing the buzz down.
Yeah, yeah.
You can go with anyone from history, by the way.
All right, okay. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, let me just throw out Clap.
Just, would you ever go on? Yeah. What do you mean?
Just a gobshite.
Sure, he'd be out for dinner with Ferguson and anyway, trying to learn all about football stuff.
So. Yeah.
Do you know the gas part about it is? You're just fucking saying that to be Gary O'Hanlon. You would kill to sit and have dinner with Klopp.
Yeah.
You'd fucking kill to sit with him. Oh, you're talking shit.
No. I'd just be just one of them faces you like to slap. Do you know what I mean? He's a bit of a legend, though.
And you've made a rod for our back here by saying three and three. Yeah. Give us another one.
I don't know, yeah. Who could be...
I'm going to stay in the world. Your man Donald Trump is somebody that I'd have no interest in being in his company. I just think the guy is... I'm taking the political route, I know, but just everything about him is just everything that I don't like. I have a rule in my life. I brought it in a few years ago that I just try and spend no time with assholes.
Yeah.
And because I just find sometimes in your life, people that you just don't like creep into your life.
Mm.
And I think everybody should just eliminate it. So if you're hanging out with me, it means I don't think you're...
I also think he'd have dreadful table manners.
Oh, yeah. Everything about him.
Can you imagine?
Everything about him.
Just, he'd be horrible to be around to watch eat. He'd be dropping, chicken wings on the ground, and it'd be like, it'd just be all over the gaff. Nah, that's a great shout.
I'll tell you, Patrick Reed would be one for me. Like, he's a pro golfer. He's in the LIV Golf Tour now. Like, he's had a few episodes over the last few years of sort of cheating. And the one thing that's so incredible about golf is it really is a gentleman, gentlewoman sport. Like, the integrity of it is paramount. It's very much self-refereed. And anybody from an amateur to a professional, if you cheat at golf.
Sorry, whose name did you say I missed?
Patrick Reed.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. He's a bit of a bad boy. I think he's a Georgia boy. He lives not a million miles away from Augusta, Georgia. His own family don't even talk
to him. He's got a hateful head in him as well.
You know, he has, yeah. He has a hateful bit of a head about him, all right, yeah. And, yeah, so the likes of him now, I'd sit across the table and I'd struggle not to fail him now, you know what I mean? It would be, yeah.
Okay, we'll just do two and two.
That's enough,
you know,
I think.
That's enough thrashing people.
We're in hell already. Or,
yeah, exactly. It's turning into
Let's
one
move
of those.
On, yeah.
Right, this is a good question now, and it's something that I've thought about on and off throughout my career. And so it's, how much would winning a Michelin star mean to you both, or do you care? Honest answers now.
Oh, well, whether people know it or not, I'd say I really knocked on the door in 2013. And I
remember you telling me this.
Yeah, I won't get into it too much, but to the point where I nearly was led down the path even by Michelin that I...
Explain the process, Gary, to people. Like, you're working in a restaurant and there's a shout that you're in for a Michelin star, what happens?
Yeah, well, I suppose, like, you're getting that visit, you know what I mean? A lot of chefs, you know, we've got lots of friends in high places that are also cooking at a really good level. And right down to the cars in the car park, I mean, I would have taken details off a critic's car, number plates, model, colour, phone numbers, names, at a list of maybe 50-something alias names at the time. So very, very much... You know, you would ring one or two guys, you know, Michael there in Chapter One would be brilliant, one out of the blue, and he would always be really nice to share info if you felt you had somebody flagged. So 12th of March 2013, I definitely flagged one about 2 or 3 weeks out, and it had a few inspections that year or whatever. But look, going back to the question, it's not something that I ever woke up, never felt it was good enough to be waking up every day thinking about stars at one best restaurant in Ireland that year. And you definitely know in your heart of hearts that you're starting to cook really good at a small restaurant, no lunch, no whatever, 5-day operation, everybody on, everybody off. I had a real, real hummingbird of a system in place and was really proud about what we were doing. But to say that, you know, we were going to work every day and chatting with Michelin was literally never ever spoken about. But if that ever had happened, it would have been the greatest day of my life and a lot of people's lives, you know what I mean? So anybody that says they don't care, I think they're a liar. I mean, it really is the pinnacle. It's not something.
There is lads walk away from Michelin, but to have
there's lads that walk away from Michelin when they nearly know Michelin are about to walk away from them. Like a lot of people in particular in Ireland have been smart enough to do that, and you know, knew when to get out or whatever, or just left because I mean, that's fine. If you get it and you feel like leaving it down the line, hey, that's up to you. There was a lot of period there during the recession where people couldn't keep up with expensive ingredients. Sometimes people maybe feel they need expensive stuff for this anyway. That's not really how Michelin works either. But I suppose the question is, you know, would it matter to you? How much would it mean? It would have meant the world. But then I think immediately if you were to get it, I think everything changes then. Then it's the fear of losing it. Because, you know, I look at Kevin Thornton. He won it, got one, won a second one, then lost one, and then another few years went by and then lost both. And he never recovered. He closed the restaurant then. And I'm not saying that maybe his time was getting close to closing anyway, but there's no doubt if you know Kevin well, that would have hurt. Like, it would have affected him. I don't think there's anybody in Ireland looks at Kevin Thornton any other way other than the guy's probably the greatest Irish-born cooks that's ever sliced an onion.
All the lads and girls that have come through his kitchen.
Sure.
Everyone's
Kevin Thornton was just, and still is, just a phenomenal cook. Yeah. And Michelin isn't going to change that. So yes, it matters, but not to the point with me anyway that it ever dictated my day-to-day life, you know what I mean? But it would have just been, it's a global recognition. I mean, I won't get into the whole ins and outs of what actually did happen to me in 2013 because that's quite private, but it was heartbreaking, you know?
Yeah, I remember when I was in the Merion when I was 18 or 19 or 20, in and around that time, I was just coming out of my time, and I had a decision to make whether I was going to go after Michelin stars or I was going to stay in hotels.
Yeah.
And I was going to live out in Australia, and I made a conscious decision that I wanted to be a head chef of a 5-star, an exec chef of a 5-star hotel. And that sounds a bit strange that a 20-year-old was thinking like that. But I, honest, that's me being really honest. I really was thinking, I want to run a big hotel, and I want to run a big hotel back in Dublin. So when I went away, I didn't look for a job in a restaurant. I looked for a job as soon as I got to Sydney. All I was interested in was hotels, because I wanted to really understand the mechanics of how a big hotel in another country works. And as it turned out, it was probably the right decision for me at the time, because it led me on to being sponsored and being able to stay over there for the length of time that I stayed there. If I had went down the restaurant route, I probably would have come back after a year, and I probably would have went to the UK, I'd say. I would have went to England, I'd say, London, because I had friends that were over there that were cooking in those type of restaurants. But when I got over there, I really enjoyed working in hotels. So I didn't think about Michelin at all while I lived in Australia. So the year from when I was 20 up until I was about 26, it wasn't in my mind. Over there, there's no Michelin. There is no, no Michelin stars in Australia. They have things called chef hats.
I think it's coming in, though. It's close.
There's a lot of talk.
So
you work in a one hat, a two hat, a three hat restaurant. And I used to do some stages in one and two and three hat restaurants. Yeah. Stages are where you go into another chef's kitchen and you work for free and your day is off. Don't know whether there's many industries that actually do that. But what you're trying to do is go in and act like a sponge and get knowledge and get techniques and pick up different cuisines, different ways of doing things. So really what you're getting paid in is knowledge. And they're still very much part of the thing. Then when I come back home to Ireland, I was back working in the Merion again, and then I took the job in the Marker. So I'm not going to say that I've ever been chasing a Michelin star, because I haven't. It's not the type of restaurants that I've worked in or that I run.
Yeah,
I just try and cook really good, honest, ingredient-led food, which, you know, I've won accolades through the years for that. And what's
but important? I mean, I talked about it long before I became executive of the K Club, you know, like that. I'd tip my hat to any chef running 5-star hotel kitchens or 4-star hotel kitchens that have breakfast, room service,
It's a different
lunch,
skill.
Dinner, snacks, events, corporate, wedding, you name it, and then multiple restaurants at different price points. I mean,
you tip your hat just as much to anybody that's worked in a Michelin kitchen for a length of time. And you know, we've spoken about them on here before, but Kieran Glennon and Guillaume over in Gibbos, retaining 2 Michelin stars for nearly to go to 20 odd years,
20 something years,
unbelievable. The consistency that's required in that, it's like literally going in and delivering perfection, service after service, day after day. You know, it's a super impressive thing. And more than a job, it's the commitment is, it sounds stupid when you're talking about food to say something is a vocation, but it's really, and when we're not saving lives, you know, but to be that committed to getting things exactly right all the time, it's a serious commitment. So, I think that answered the question.
You're next up.
That was me that asked that. It's cheating. Maybe it's you that we're not going to invite for dinner. Or cheating.
Is there any cooking technique from your childhood, something that a parent or grandparent used to do, for example, that you still use in your cooking to this day? Absolutely not. There was such little talent floating around.
Oh, I thought it was going to be a nostalgic one.
Absolutely not.
Unless I stick on a French accent and give you a big lie about one of me grannies being a legend. No, the only cooking technique that granny, who's still alive, mammy's mammy, used to do, she used to put 10 teaspoons of sugar into a cup of tea. It's the only it's the only place I ever drank tea. No.
Here we go.
The same granny. Do you know what, actually? I will stand corrected.
Oh, here we blading go. Look at this.
She used to cook sausages on the side of a Stanley range top, right? Really low, really slow. And we used to go home when Glen Row would finish. When we stayed in that granny's, we used to visit her up at Carrigart near Downings for the day. And then my grandfather Miles, God rest him, great cat, he would drive us back home to Ramelt. And then, but we always left after Glen Row, where they have the old famous song, oh, you've never done your homework. You hear the music to Glen Row and you have to start doing your homework. But we always knew once we heard the music at the end of the show, we were hitting the road. But right on cue, as Glen Row would start, granny used to all give us sausages. And to the day I die, I'll remember I'll remember the texture of a cooked sausage, lovely, soft, even colour all the way around. But I would just be like going, Jesus, will you give me the sausages quick? Used to take her so long to cook them.
What was that about, do you know?
I don't know. It's just how she did it. She just got a bit of colour on them. She just kept them on the smallest little simmer. And they were so beautiful, man, to eat. Granny Josie, and she's still going strong. She turned 94 there, 95.
I think you may as well now apologise to her for what you said.
Take it all back, Granny Josie. Take it all back.
As you know, I've spoken about it on here before, but there was definitely a lot of things happening in my house when I was growing up because my parents were in the industry. Like, my mum worked in a hotel and my dad worked at sea. So I think I told a story on here about having crepes suzettes on Tuesday and you nearly bleed and fell off your chair. So I seen things growing
it
up.
It was some crepes suzettes.
Yeah, yeah. No, I seen my dad like making stroganoff from scratch when we were growing up because he's a fully qualified waiter. Like back then it was a 4 or 5 year apprenticeship. So like I seen him flambeing brandy and you know, flambeing Grand Marnier when I was growing up and all. So there was a real culture of food in our house.
And
from
you
the start.
Savvy, sir.
And yeah, exactly. Exactly. So yeah, there was loads of things that went on in our house that I would see happening in my professional kitchens.
Class.
So even down to, you know, how watching my dad open a bottle of wine, or he was the person that taught me how to open a bottle of champagne correctly, and you know, things that have stayed with
me. And you've opened a few of them, haven't
you? I have. As you know, I'm partial to an old glass of bubbles. But yeah, these are the type of things that you learn. And now I would think, and I would say your house is the same. Your kids are going to have memories of food, memories that they're going to have for and carry through to their kids. Hopefully, that's
We had a lovely speaking of crepes, we had a lovely crepe morning on Saturday. Yeah,
can't be it, can't you know?
Stuffed crepes is what Cora wanted. They went through the pancake phase, but they still pull up a seat, like they pull the three island,
hand the pants.
Potty, Ollie, and Cora, they pull the seats up and they're all watching. So one cracks the eggs, one's adding in the sugar, and it's great. They all get stuck in, it's brilliant, yeah.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Giving you a helping hand with your food frustrations.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us. Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Subscribe for free on the Go Loud app and never miss an episode.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Well, here's a good question, actually. I have to say, top marks for the questions.
Thank you very much.
What, where, and when do chefs eat during a shift? Do you eat at all? Or do you need to keep your palate fresh?
You definitely don't need to keep your palate fresh. You're constantly kind of eating. This is one thing. I come home and Annette says, what did you eat today? And she knows right away when I'm telling her a lie that I actually stopped and sat down to eat. Probably one day in 5 or 6, I'll actually stop and sit and eat. And that's because I've probably gone too far. I eat every day, but I usually eat standing up. There's no point in for all the stupidity of it, I still do it. I go into the main hotel kitchen into Marek's, my head chef, in the Barton room at the K Club. I might have like a chicken, tomato and lettuce sandwich, chatting to him. And then Fernando, my pastry chef, I nearly always steal a little tiny scone on my way out. You know what I mean? If I'm up in the Palmer, I'll try 5 or 6 different things. I want to try the chowder, the Cullen Skink, it'll be a few teaspoons of that. I want to taste a curry if there's a curry on. I want to taste the mash if there's a Kilcannon being made. And then I might just say, give me a chicken wing or two, or let me taste the sauce, or give me a crostini and I'll eat it, but whatever. There I want to taste as many little things as I can and go, and then I go into South. It's the same thing over there. There's so many things that I want to know. I'll go into my conference kitchen if there's a wedding on or a corporate event, and depending on what it could be, anything from a salad to a ratatouille to a braised cabbage to God knows what. So because I have so many kitchens and such every one of them has action every single day, I'm tasting in all of them. I never get hungry. I very rarely get to the point where I'm able to be hungry enough, A, to sit down and eat something, but B, I like to leave a bit of appetite for all the eating and all the tasting, you know, which isn't a great way of eating, but such is life, you know. But I eat well, and I'm never starved, as you can tell. You know, I know you're what you're going to say here.
What?
You've got absolute definite times where you stop and you sit and you eat, and you'll drink a bottle of water because you're a superstar as well. Am I right?
Well, as I'm sitting here with a bottle of water, no, I used to eat the way you were talking about, and a few years ago, I had to stop that because my habits were terrible. They had me feeling like crap. I was tired. I wasn't, as you know, I like to try and get a bit of exercise in most days. Most mornings I start with a run or something before I go into work. And then I'll go in and I'll make myself an omelette, or I'll have a couple of poached eggs or whatever. And I always sit down and eat lunch in the staff restaurant. Yeah. At some point.
Well, I do that too a bit, yeah.
Yeah, but
they like to see the chef in there.
And you know, it's one of the reasons, because like
why
a staff restaurant is somewhere where people are eating in there every day, and like I think it just goes, like I try and encourage my chefs to go in and sit down and eat as much as possible. They never do. Chefs are a breed of people that I've done it many times. I catch a pastry chef sitting in eating our dinner, sitting on a, you know, a footstool in the pastry or whatever. Yeah. I'd be like, why are you sitting there?
Yeah.
Go inside, take
chat
a break.
Your colleagues.
Yeah, and they'd be like, oh, no, no. And I says, it's not because you're too busy. You have time.
Yeah.
No, and then I'd speak to the pastry chef running that department. I'm like, come on, make your team go in and sit down and have a break. Yeah. Like, and eat. Now, they have breaks. Of course they do. But I think it's a bad habit.
It's a bad habit.
So I do try and put a bit of discipline around my... Now, Gary, of course, there's days when I go in and we're just so far up the walls that you just...
I know.
And it sounds like a really stupid thing to say, but you forget to eat. But the reality is...
Well, you do forget to eat. You know, the one thing I love about the staff room is I might see Molly. Like, Molly's a good friend of mine. He's one of the head guys over the golf courses. And I've known Molly from even my time in France, because he used to come over. He's very close to the CEO and the GM of the Chateau in France. So Liam Grehan, who's going to be one of our future... Parik Harrington's, he's a pro that's on one of the Clutch Tour right now.
So you track all for him.
So if I see the boys in the staff rooms, I'm like, oh, you know, because you're not all, you're not always bumping into them boys. So like definitely, like if it's around lunchtime, you're like, oh Jesus, Molly's in there or Liam's in there or one of the boys from the course, I'll grab some of the food. And then my chefs that look after that staff restaurant, then I think it's a nice wee bit of respect then for them to see you eating their stuff as well. So yeah, must do better, but...
Then in relation to, like, if in small restaurants, for example, I would know, we'll sit and eat every day before service.
Yeah.
Nearly all restaurants, it'll be someone's job in the kitchen, it'll be on staff food. Staff food will generally look like, you know, a piece of chicken or a piece of beef or something with some pasta. And it's really, if you're on staff meal... Everybody else is kind of going, look, what's he going to cook with? So
when I was in the old post, it was the last man in. Used to do it, or sometimes we'd do a week about, like, but if you had a commie there or whatever, you say, right, now's your time to shine.
Yeah, exactly.
Put in a good shift, and you've got the best palates that restaurant will ever see sitting down at 5:30 or 6:00 right before it opens. You better have the salt and pepper,
right? You get it wrong. You know all about it.
You know all about it. Who's up, mate?
You're up, yeah.
Now, what dish is the other better at than you? And, what are you better at than them? So,
Jesus Christ, Ed, man, you're ruthless.
I'm trying to split the two of you up at the feet.
It's hard to know that, actually. One thing about me and Gareth is I'd say we're very, very, very similar. And there's lots of chefs in Ireland, maybe cooking at my level and your level, that I would say, you know, they're way more seafood orientated than me, for example, or they go down. But we definitely would be two chefs, I'd say, like that. The things that we seem to like for all the years that we know each other now, like, you know.
Well, there's one thing that I know I started, and I only know this because we'd spoken about it. I got into sourdough bread a good bit over lockdown.
Yeah.
And myself and the guy I spoke about earlier on, Kieran Glennon and Graham Neville from Dax, they were helping me more than I was helping them, but we were kind of swapping techniques, and it was one thing in my career that I never really gave an awful lot of time to. I can make all the different yeast breads, like brioches, white breads, no bother. But sourdough I always found a little bit tricky. So I did practice that a lot, and I know you had said to me that you nearly started it, but you never got it.
I have literally never
There you go.
Made.
And I bet you people would be surprised to hear that.
They will be shocked. Yeah. I have never.
But you would never do it.
There's loads of breads I make, and I am a lovely baker, but I've just out of
patience,
and I've got all my chefs doing it already. They do it. Joe Ahora is one of my best buddies up in Donegal, Benny and Co. in Balbuffet. Joe has given me a couple of starters over the years, like Riot Rye. Is it John Fitzmaurice, whatever you call him? That's his company, Riot Rye. Like, Big Joe Ahora is one of the best bread bakers in Ireland, and he's been so kind to give me a starter a couple of times that I still
killed it.
So yeah, I just let it die. Yeah, I never used it. You know what I mean? So yeah, you'd have the upper hand on me.
Yeah,
on that.
And you know, I often hear you talking about different techniques that you learned over in the States. There's often you talk, and it's evident that you've spent time cooking in America. I know you haven't.
Yeah.
So you talk about different sauces and different techniques and. And I kind of go, geez, I never even thought of that. So I'd often leave here and go and I'd have a read up about, you know, a kind of a sandwich that you spoke about. So I think that's what's cool about the world of cookery. That
I should have asked just this question. Who's better at barbecue?
Oh, yeah. Well, there we think we need to have a barbecue off.
Now we're talking.
Yeah, I would be nifty enough now. And he's not too shabby either.
He's
like
a messy Ronaldo.
Well, I'd say the both of us are better than
you. He'd want to be wearing his socks over his kneecaps that day.
Yeah. Bleeding double chin guards on, I'd say that day. Okay, so we kind of answered that one here. This is a good one. Can you remember the moment you knew that you were absolutely going to pursue a career in the kitchen? And also, was there moments when you came close to packing it all in?
Never, ever, ever came close to packing it in. Anyway, I can safely say that. I would have worked with my old boy growing up, you know, would have worked on the farm a lot, and we would have worked on wild oysters and wilks and stuff like that. But the night before my 15th birthday, my junior cert finished, you know, I thumbed the Downings. And so my first day in the Rosapenna was I probably lied. Like, I mean, I probably shouldn't say that, but I turned 15 the next day anyway, 26th of June, 1993. And I was in the kitchen. I've cut myself three times that I can remember in all my 31 years. And one of them was that first day. I had
hospital cut yourself?
No. I kind of stuck just the top of my thumb back on. I just kept pressing it. And it eventually like pulled a wee bit off. So the tip of my left thumb like kind of came off. And I had a Victorinox knife. I just couldn't believe how how sharp it was. And I had a haricot vert. I had a big green bean. I was just like right hand flicking the knife at it. And of course, sure enough, I flicked the top of my thumb off. Blood just went up in the air. But anyway, I remember making this. Mr. Casey used to call this Dauphinesse potato. I still make them in the keg club, and I make them at home for Annette. Potatoes, onion, diced ham, diced tomatoes.
You've shared
diced
this
onion,
recipe a couple of times.
Cream, no garlic, cream, salt, white pepper, and then you bake that, finish it with cheddar. I remember the first night I made that, I was like, wow. And for dinner in the Rosapenna that night, like, my auntie's the head chef of the Rosapenna. She was over 40 years. She gave me this breaded plaice. I'd never eaten plaice or whatever, but there was plaice on the dinner menu that night. I got plaice, munch too, and I had corn, and then there was a buttered carrot and something else, the potatoes and another type of potato. But I remember going into the staff restaurant eating it going,
what is this?
Just the flavour, the carrot. I keep going back to the flavour and the carrots, right? And then the next night it was broccoli. And I was like, my mind was absolutely, but it was always the vegetables and the potatoes, right? Or whatever about the meat and that, right? I just couldn't believe how nice she was making vegetables. I would be trying to say to mommy, oh, I don't want any carrots, whatever. You'll eat them. You need to eat them. You're playing food. You need to eat them. But I'd eat them only because I was feared of her. You know what I mean? Like, I had to eat them. But Jesus, it was no hardship eating them in the Rosapenna, I can tell you that. Like, and that used to blow my mind. And I was like, I'm doing this the rest of my life. There's just no
doubt. And you've never had any points where you're like,
ugh. I've had really down periods. Like, I've had periods where, you know, it's hard work and you feel no matter how hard you're working. Like, you know, the first few years in Viewmount, I never had a food critic come. I knew we were brilliant. I knew it was an amazing place. There was a recession. Newspapers, critics maybe weren't being paid to go down the country. I used to get really despondent about that. But, you know, when you're going into work at 7 or 8 in the morning, working till 11 or 12 at night, 5, 6 days a week, you feel that you're owed something, but nobody knows that. Like, you're in your own world. You're trying to open the place. Like, I leave the house now at 6 or 7 o'clock to go to the K Club, and, you know, it takes me an hour to get there. You're there all day. It's just an amazing career. You're going from different types of restaurants, events, whatever, but it's taken a whole career to be able to do the one now. But yeah, like, if I told you that there wasn't times where, you know, maybe not pack it in, like, but there was definitely times where it was like, going, Jesus, there has to be an easier way of making shillings than this. It's just so thankless sometimes, you know what I mean? But look, it's what I do, and it's probably the only thing I can do. I'm useless at pretty much everything else. Do you know what I mean? What about you?
I'm in professional kitchen since I'm 14 or 15, I think. My brother worked out in UCD, out in O'Reilly Hall, so it was a big catering place, and I started washing pots like most of us do, and then I started helping the chefs a little bit, and then I was like, this is a career for me. And I remember a lot of people saying to me, oh, it's unsociable hours and all of those things. And then when I done my leaving cert, then I went and got a job in the hotel, and I remember at the start I found that really hard. I found, because when I was out in O'Reilly Hall, it wasn't like a kitchen that was servicing a restaurant, so your hours would be, you weren't,
yeah, it was
like
daytime.
Yeah, it was, yeah, daytime, nighttime, some weekends you were off. So it wasn't the structure of a hotel. And I remember when I went from that, and I obviously, because I'd worked there from when I was 14 or 15 up until I was 18, I knew everything that was going on, you know. So not that you think you're, you know, but when you go into a hotel then, and then it's just totally different gravy, because you're, pardon the pun, but you're like doing things that you've never seen before. There's techniques you're saying, and there's an awful lot of like doubt gets in your mind, yeah. And that's where I feel that if you're in the right kitchen with the right chef, they see people getting that doubt. And I always remember Ed Cooney saying to me, I know you, Ed's a friend of both of ours, he's the chef over in Marion. I remember him saying, like, you know, as you grow up, a lot of your friends will probably be within the industry. Yeah. Like, I know at the moment most of your friends are working Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, he says, but as you get a little bit older, that Friday and Saturday night won't mean as much. And it's always, I've said that now to loads of people in my career, young chefs starting out, yeah, going, don't worry about it. And the world now is very different. I mean, back then, 20 odd years ago, like, you couldn't go out on a Sunday night. There was nothing open. And where, yeah, then, when you get, like now, I mean, there's big nights out on a Tuesday night, mm-hmm, and Wednesday night, and there's...
Well, that'd be... For years, I used to say to Nettie, you know, like, I'd be leaving to go to Viewmount at about 11 or 12 or just after 12 on a Saturday. And I'd be shaking my head, and she'd see me move from a distance, you know, like the boys would be on, like, whenever Soccer Saturday was brilliant, and I'd be like, oh, Jesus,
I'd love to be
at home now, just watching football all day. So anyway, in more recent years, in the winter, when we'd be off-season at the Chateau, I'd be at home or whatever, get up on a Saturday morning, and it's like, right, well, I'm going here, I'm going there, you've got Potty or Cora or Ollie, he's got training there, she's got football there. And I was like, going,
in front of the telly,
this being off on Saturday's a load of bollocks. It's a nightmare. Do you know what I mean? So
I wish I was going to work.
Ed Cooney was absolutely spot on. I was like, going,
but you know, the other thing, give me work any day. I really enjoyed when my kids were younger, was bringing them to school. Aye. And like, you know, I was able to bring my kids around to school.
I love bringing Cora and Ollie in.
Yeah, but you know, when sometimes you're around there and like you see, and I don't mean this as a sexist comment, but there's not a lot of men dropping their kids to school.
No.
You know, maybe it's just where my kids went to school. But, and I used to remember thinking, and I'd drop them to school, I'd go home and have a cup of coffee and I'd go to work. You know, and I'd do that 2, 3, 4 mornings a week if needed, you, yeah, know. So the flexibility that my job gives.
Did they fit in the bike?
Hmm?
Did
they? Oh, yeah. Bungee cord to the back bumper and just drag them around. No, they go to school just around the corner.
So, yeah.
No, I'd walk around, and there are the little things that,
yeah,
you know, that he was trying to say to me all those years ago when I was 17 or 18, and all, yeah, I heard about was, well, how come I can't go out on a Saturday night? But, you know, the minute work was over, 10 o'clock.
Ed, older or wiser.
Exactly.
Older or wiser.
I've spoken about him before as well, but Aldrin Lucy is the same. He was one of the sous chefs there, so.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, who is the most famous person you've ever cooked for?
Jesus.
Jeez, I've cooked for a lot of celebs.
Mm.
It's hard to know, though, because one man's famous person is another man's. Who are they?
Yeah. I made an omelette and a club sandwich for Obama. That was pretty. He was pretty up there.
I fed Clinton.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Never met him though.
Yeah.
Which always annoyed me. Let me see. Madonna. Lots of female. I'll tell you one that I really...
I have a story I'm going to tell.
And there was... So it was only me and him, right? He landed in around 1 a.m. and I remember saying there was Padraig Harrington, who, you know, arguably the greatest. He's, tonight he's going to be inducted into Golf Hall of Fame, which is just incredible, by the way. I love Paddy Harrington on a level. And you talk about it took everything in me. I mean, I would never break rank and ask for a picture or anything like that, you know. I often see that, like, with celebrities staying in hotels and staff taking pictures. Like, I really judge them. I'm like, what are you doing?
There's policy on me against that.
Jesus, like, it's... Right. But you see it all the time. There's a few restaurants in Dublin, boys are always putting up pictures. And I just think, mate, what are you doing? Like, you look like such a fool when you do that, you know. But that's just me. Maybe I'm used to seeing them around. But I think, like, if you're at the higher end of the bracket... Let them come and let them be respectful, yeah. And that's how you get them back, is you don't annoy them. But Paddy flew in late, and he got whatever he wanted. It was 1 o'clock in the morning. I says, I don't care what time he lands, I'm going to be here. He can have whatever he wants. But then the next morning, he was in the breakfast room, and he breakfasted on his own, and I cooked Chef Table style for him. And again, just chatting away, just lovely guy.
Sound.
Yeah, really sound, yeah. And I just, all I wanted to do is get my arm around him and hug him and kiss his cheek. I just wanted to tell him how amazing he was, you know what I mean? But I controlled myself, yeah.
Well, good.
Yeah.
Happy to hear that, yeah, Brian.
I fucking love him. What about you?
I remember I was working on the overnight shift in room service in a 5-star hotel, and I got a phone call off the night manager that there was a lady up in the bar wanted to know what caviar we had in stock.
Oh.
And I was only a blading commie, man. I hadn't a clue what was going on, right? And I was like, I don't, who is it? And he was like, it's Dolores O'Riordan.
Oh.
And I was like, who's that? I didn't a blading clue who she was, right? And I went, here, I'll go and have a look. And anyway, and I went up to the blade fridge in the chef's office and I got the caviar and I came back down and was like, tell her we have beluga.
Oh, no.
Anyway, she was like, she wanted the chef to go up and talk to her about it and all, you know. And I was like, I was saying to her, man, I don't know enough about it. I said, look, I can prepare it. Yeah. So in a hotel.
This was before Google.
Oh, this was blade and gone back. What, 25 years ago maybe, even a little bit longer. But anyway, I prepared the caviar for her, and caviar in a 5-star hotel normally comes with like 8 or 10 garnishes. So you have like chopped egg yolk, chopped egg white, chives, shallots, Malba toast, capers, little bit of creme fraiche, and you put the caviar in the middle. Anyway, I got the tray ready, polished the tray, made a thing called a gondola, which is like a folding napkin, and I brought it up to the bar,
shaking,
man. And I just brought it in, and she was deep in conversation with somebody, so she didn't need me to talk to her about it. And then when I seen her, I knew who it was, because the night manager wasn't an Irish bloke. He couldn't tell me what it was. So anyway, I left it there. The way I brought it over, I left it for her, the 8th caviar. And then she sent me down a dropsy, a few bob as a tip.
Oh.
She said, tell the chef, it was amazing.
Nice.
And luckily he brought it. Now, sometimes they don't play and give it to the chef. You don't see it. So he came down, and the caviar tin was empty, and she loved it. And it's just something that stuck in my mind. And I remember thinking, I've a bloody mad job.
A quick one on the cranberries, right? So Mix 98.5, I don't know if you know Boston Radio, Ed,
but
well, your game, 98.5 would be like the Today FM of New England, for example. So at Christmas, they used to have this, like the Holiday Hoedown, it was called, the Mix 98.5 Holiday Hoedown. And it was Coldplay, who had never been to America, Coldplay, Alanis Morissette, Bare Naked Ladies, and then the Cranberries.
Wow.
And it was in the Fleet Center, or the Garden, as it's known as, where the Boston Celtics play. So we all went, right? And I'll never forget it. First band up, lights are still on. off Chris Martin starts, and anyway, they go, right? He's a song and a half in, and then he sort of stops. And he goes, in a really polite English accent, he goes, excuse me, he goes, this time next year, we're going to be the biggest band in the world. Would you please have the good manners to turn off the lights, or we just will never ever come back.
Wow.
But it will mean an awful lot to me if you just turned off the lights. I know none of you knows, but the 4,000 or 5,000 that had already been in there, parachutes had come out about 2 or 3 weeks earlier. All the Paddies living there and in Boston had been getting it sent over by everybody that they knew in England and Ireland. So we were all there for kind of Coldplay, you know, and I know I was there for Coldplay. Anyway, lights go down, show goes on, Coldplay, Alanis Morissette's whole set, she had laryngitis. A fan sang her set, who took the roof off, by the way. Then the Bare Naked Ladies played. But then the Cranberries came on. And I wasn't a fan of the Cranberries, right? But oh, my goodness. When Dolores O'Riordan started singing.
That voice.
Something happened in my head. I was like, that it sounded surreal. I was like, how is she that good? And that's the one and only Cranberries gig I was ever at. But proud to be Irish that all those bands that were on before, or those musicians, she was the, they were the headliner.
Yeah,
and I was like, oh my God. Unbelievable. Goodness. Unreal, man. Unreal.
I was in the W in Sydney, it was like down at the water. It was like an old shipping thing, right? And Pink done a concert in the hotel. It was a
top floor.
I got to listen to her do her sound check. There was no one in. Yeah. Oh man.
Yeah.
But she wasn't using any there was no microphone, and she was just singing. And I was watching her, and I was saying to one of the lads, "Jeez, man, the sound system's unbelievable here." And he looked at me and goes,
"She wasn't even using it."
He goes, "She's just bleeding singing there, man." Jesus. Unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah, she's good.
So that, like, to kind of wrap this up, in the world of chefing, you can find yourself in mad situations.
Yeah.
You know, so
we find ourselves. I mean, Jesus, we could be cooking for anybody in our game. It's really.
What must
cool.
happen to you that when you walk into a
restaurant, big time, yeah, yeah.
No, but like,
I'm just saying, hey, the man is a really noisy motorbike, doesn't he?
But someone gets word back to the chef, just give you a heads up. Gar Mullins and Gary O'Hanlon are in, and like, hear all the delf clattering to the floor.
Make sure you season the spuds. Okay, so thanks for tuning in. We're not going to deal with culinary conundrums because we've given you enough culinary nonsense there to last you a lifetime. Well, at least last you until next week. But thanks as always for tuning in, and we'll talk to you next week.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Subscribe for free on the Go Loud app and never miss an episode.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.